the Sunday Morning Linux Review with Mary Tomich, Tom Lawrence, and Tony Bemis as the Beaver.
And this is episode 231. We didn't even talk about a name.
We didn't talk about a name. That's the name of it. We didn't talk about a name.
All right.
That'll save us about 3 minutes of discussion.
This is Tony Bemis.
And Tom Lawrence.
And so what did you do this week, Tom?
Oh, boy. Well, I'll start with I played with the FreeNAS 10, got a video on that. And I may have to throw a link in the show notes to it. I do a I think it's a 40-minute video. It's like a walkthrough of all the features of FreeNAS and some of the things I hate. Like, as of right now, if you're running the – they've fixed some of the issues that I'm ranting about, but they were not fixed then. And I actually comment on that. That is, you know, I know there's all stuff in a pipeline to repair these things, but among the things they can't do was – from the web interface, you can't replace a hard drive that goes bad in a RAID array. That's
yeah, that
all command line. Yeah, because it's easy. It's arbitrarily easy to do when the later in the 9 series version of FreeNAS, it works fine. Matter of fact, I've swapped out bad hard drives all the time. The bigger, more critical flaw is I encrypt all my hard drives. And that way, when a hard drive goes bad, because that happens, and I've actually had a couple of my RAID array go bad, we ship them out to the manufacturer and think nothing of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because it's encrypted, so it doesn't matter.
Well, in FreeNAS 10, they kind of messed up, and you can't replace an encrypted drive.
What?
Yeah, it breaks the system. You can't even mount the array. So if you have a RAID Z3, Z2, Z1, doesn't seem to matter, or even just a mirror, if the drives are encrypted and you remove one of the encrypted drives, you are in hell with that thing trying to get it to work.
Wow.
That's one of the big fixes they did have. I can't believe it made it out of beta with that, though. That's kind of... I mean, that's like the first thing I have when I've done my other FreeNAS videos is encrypt your drives. That way, if a drive goes bad, you're not going, oh, my God, I can't send this back to the manufacturer. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's just like step one. So there's that. I also had a RAID array failure on our mirrored system that's not FreeNAS. That is my Linux box that runs all the virtual machines, which is why we have RAID arrays. So that failure was odd. And I went to add another virtual machine for something I was working on, and the load on the system went nuts. And I'm like, okay. It just went to, like, fully pinned. Really? It had a load of, like, 30. It just wasn't going. The virtual machines were still working, but I think that's because they get pushed into memory so much. I'm not exactly sure. They seem to have read-write access, but it was sluggish. So before I shut it off, I'm like, I'm going to have to touch this thing off with something clearly horrible has happened. And we ran a quick backup on each of the machines and shut them down. We didn't do a full back. We just had to do the data backups, SQL dumps, and shut it down. And then it would not even come on anymore. And this hard drive, the whole machine boots off SSDs, and it's a rated SSD array. So nothing but SSDs in the machine, which makes it really, really quiet and cool.
Yeah.
The hard drive, the machine will not power on. It powers on, but it will not boot at all. It locks up on the BIOS. This hard drive failed so hard.
Wow.
So that was really weird. It doesn't tell me, like, smart failure. I had no indications. I get notices if there's any smart errors. All I did was try to add a file. It was a big file because I build a virtual machine on my computer, and I import them into the my virtual stack once it's ready, and that's where the failure occurred. That drive failed catastrophically. It's not readable. Matter of fact, any computer we plug it into, it won't go past the BIOS screen.
Holy cow.
So it's a dead SSD. It's under warranty. It was encrypted, so we sent it back. And it's got a few-year warranty on them. So that was fun. other than that, I've been playing with the Unify equipment, which is pretty awesome. We just got into the Unify cameras because I love them. They run on Linux servers. Other than that, the big exciting news that it's not officially announced anywhere on social media, but I have a feeling – that there's probably not a massive crossover of people who listen to us and will comment on Facebook. So we're holding off on the actual release on it, but I'll give you guys the inside scoop. We got a new building, my company did, and we've been remodeling it, getting ready to move in. We're hoping to move in about a couple of weeks. So
awesome.
That's been the exciting side of things. So that's most of what I'm doing. So now I'm painting. So now I'm doing physical work, which Tom doesn't usually do. So my shoulders are sore, and I need to get in shape apparently because I painted a lot of square footage.
It's a nice big space.
It's a very big space. It's well over double what we had, and there's going to be a lot more YouTube videos and all kinds of stuff happening there. So that's We're, you know, if anyone's watched any of my shop tours, we're actually kind of crammed in there, and we've just been looking for over a year, and just have not found a place because I don't know. There's many vacant buildings, and nobody wants to give a deal. So it took a year to make a deal work out.
Yeah,
Tony knows because I've told him we got this idea, and Tony's like, "Did you get that?" I'm like, "No, one fell through too."
Yeah, I think we've on our drives back and forth, we've talked about five different buildings,
just in the last 3 months, even, man.
Yeah,
I mean, some of these deals come so close to finishing, and just people are weird at own buildings, and I'm in a weird area. Because there is a mass amount of vacancies where we're at. There's all over the place vacancies, and they still want to charge. I mean, the building we're in now, just to give you a price comparison, the one that we're going to be moving into in a few weeks is one-third the price of the quote I got from literally 3 miles away. One-third. And I'm like, how do you guys, you know, you're talking similar spaces, roughly the same square footage. Actually, the building we're getting is 200 square feet bigger and on a newer, more into the city area versus the other ones towards the more rural, further away from the city, only by 3 miles, so pretty insignificant. But they think the building's worth triple the amount per month. And that's the kind of stuff I don't get. So, and I've learned that about commercial real estate. Like, you can – houses, because there's so much frequent turnover, there's a baseline of pricing. There's no MLS system for all commercial listings. It doesn't exist.
Really?
So people literally charge whatever they want for buildings, and there's not a commonality because no two buildings are alike. They're not as cookie cutter as houses. So there's no fair market comparison. It's just a general market comparison.
Wow.
And so you pay whatever the owner negotiates, and that's just kind of how it works. Some people pay a lot. Some people pay a little. So it's just weird.
It sure is.
But, trying to see what other project. We had some other Linux-y stuff we were doing. Besides the Unify stuff, we were just looking – I've been looking at Proxmox. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at different ways to do our virtual stack because of the FreeNAS 10 thing. It was really – I love the concept of building one solid unified box on top of everything. FreeNAS 10 just doesn't feel like it's there yet, but they're coming. But it made me think, okay, why not just run all that? Because right now we have our virtual stack of systems that run our critical infrastructure, and it's just Linux RAID arrays. It's not ZFS. I really love ZFS, the snapshotting. I love all the concepts, and I found out Proxmox, which I've looked at a long time ago but not recently, does all of those things. So expect a review of that. It's a really sweet – if you haven't heard of Proxmox, look it up. It's really cool.
I have a friend running it. At his house, he has like two or three VMs that he does, and he said it works really good for him. He likes it.
Out of the box, I just didn't know this, it supports the high availability, so you can pair up Proxmox servers together. And so I guess if one fails, the VM can run on both. It's got some features for that. So I'm like, that's pretty awesome. So with computers and equipment being so inexpensive, buying a pair of Blade servers for redundancy and mating them together with Proxmox is – very affordable.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, one of my clients is tanking, and there might be an opportunity to buy some server equipment that's really lightly used.
Yeah.
So, and they have some paired up servers like that. So I'm like, I might do a review of this. It's not on my to do list, but the building project first, and then we'll look at Proxmox. Oh, tinfoil hat time. I have been just double checking, triple checking security for everything because the amount of attacks are just crazy out there. So we've just been – I mean, we use pfSense, and we're using the country blocker and everything. And just the number of people hammering on ports is just off the wall.
In your office?
Yeah, in my office, other clients' offices, all of them. Huh. So it's just – we've just been looking at the threat reports. And we have one client with a RDP, and because we manage it and we told them we really want something better on there. We want them to switch to Duo because Duo has an RDP authenticator. So they can do that, and they haven't done it yet, but I'm pushing them for it. Well, we use really long passwords is the answer I get. I'm like, you realize there are 4,000 attempts a day. This is behind the firewall after we do country code blocking. And we added the firewall with country code blocking because it was somewhere in the range of 30,000 times a day. Like sometimes the server would just pause because of that many login attempts on an RDP port.
Really?
It's insane.
Holy
and
cow.
Now we're down to like 4,000 a day. And I'm like, you guys are – it's a matter of time before someone guesses the password. And that kind of happened to one of our clients. We had to lock them out. They kept getting one account kept getting locked out. We couldn't figure out why. RDP. Someone had their username and just kept trying every password, and it would cause the account to get locked out on our system.
Yeah.
and Active Directory. So, oh, by the way, Windows sucks if you've had to deal with Active Directory and figuring out why an account's locked out. By default, Windows doesn't tell you why. It just says account locked out for too many attempts, but it doesn't tell you where those attempts come from.
Yeah.
I found a tool that tells you.
Really?
It's called Nutrix Account AD Tool, and that's what it does. Because we had an account lockout without RDP. This is funny. The HP printer they installed, when they installed it, it set up a service to run as the user with the original password.
Really?
So somehow when they decided to change your password, the HP software didn't sync at some point, so it kept trying their old password and locking their account out.
Oh, geez.
So uninstalling the HP printer fixed the account lockout problem. That was super hard to find because all it says is – and it kept saying it was from his local. I was like, dude, you're hammering your password on there because we turned on logging.
Was it the printer itself or was it a software on its computer?
The service HP runs called something HP Update Schedule Service. It had to run it with his user-level permission of some sort because it's on a domain with Active Directory. It was a local printer plugged in next to his computer, and
it was software on his computer doing that, not the printer itself.
Right, which makes it more confusing to find because it looks like he's typing his password wrong until he locks himself out.
Yeah.
But then we realized when we started using the tool, first we turned on logging in Active Directory, which I don't know why by default turned off, but it is, in case you didn't know. It says his computer is the source of the lockout, which makes it more confusing.
Right.
And I'm like, well, like I said, first we say it's him doing it until we looked at it. It was happening every 30 seconds, even when he wasn't in the office and he's on the phone with us. We're like, are you trying to log in every 30 seconds exactly at 30 seconds, like consistently throughout the day? And he's like, no. I said, okay, I didn't think so.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was the headaches. So that's kind of my catch up. I mean, I could go on, but.
That's crazy.
We work in IT. We could always rant about some of the crazy things we have to deal with because, the sad state of affairs that is the world we work in.
You know what would probably fix part of that kind of issue? If you use service accounts. And then, I mean, it's an application on his PC, but same idea as a service account and give it limited access. So it only does what it needs to do.
Yeah.
And then he doesn't have to worry about his user account being tied to that other service.
And he installed it himself. I didn't even think HP would have done it that way.
Yeah,
like, this
strange.
Is an HP problem.
Hmm.
And here's the weird thing. The printer's been there for 2 years.
Do they have a proxy?
No.
Oh. Yeah, because I would say sometimes if you have to put in proxy information, then that would be a hard-coded or not hard-coded, but that would be a password that it would save within the application. But
generally when we install the HP – one of the things I got to say for Windows 10, as much as I hate it, is the fact that it does install printers without installing the crapware.
Nice.
So that's actually been a nice – they plug in the printer, it just works. They don't have to go put the HP software in because the HP software is ridiculously bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember having to install some of those and you uncheck everything. Like the default installs 10 things.
Yeah.
And if you say, I just want the drivers, then you go in and there's all 10 of those can undo because by default – or by at the minimum is just the driver.
Oh, yeah. The HP used to install this HP web view. I don't know if you ever had to deal with it. It breaks websites.
Really?
Yeah. It's supposed to be to help format websites to make them more printer friendly. I'm like, one, save a tree, quit printing websites. Two, it breaks things. It just causes browser issues we've run into. And all we do is uninstall it. It's called HP web view. Just remove it and you're like, oh, look, the website opens fine. It doesn't – it's a plugin. And I'm like, why does it do that?
Wow.
I haven't dealt with it in a while. It was an older program. We don't see it as much anymore. I think HP has abandoned it too, but still.
Wow.
Who thought that was a good idea? Let's make websites more printable. Let's not leave it up to the web developers to make it printable. Also, why are you printing websites?
Yeah, exactly.
So what exciting things did you do besides whatever you're doing before you got here?
Yeah, well, what I did today. Well, so remember I was having a problem with my trying to rebuild my firewall at home, the pfSense firewall. And I went through and did some more troubleshooting on that. You know, I pulled the RAM and reseated it, put half the RAM back in, you know, that only the matching RAM was in there, and reseated the NIC card and still was same problem. And then I had another project I was building this other computer for. And I ended up not needing it. I was going to give it to a friend, and then they didn't need it anymore. And it was pretty much spec'd out the same, except for instead of a Dell, it was an HP. It was a HP. It's a dual core, or Core 2 Duo with 2 gigs of RAM. And I'm like, hey, I'll try it in that. and it came up fine. It just easy, you know. It was, I want to say, from when I put the NIC card in, did the install and plugged it into the network, was maybe 20 minutes, and it was good. So now all I have to do is transfer over the firewall rules and my NAT, or and the, yeah, it's a couple firewall rules, my NAT rules, and my static or DHCP reservations.
What's the old firewall you're using?
It was also PFSense.
Oh, okay, cool.
But it's on old hardware. It was on a Pentium 4, gig of RAM. But I want to say the hardware is from 2000.
Okay.
No, maybe 2002. But yeah, it's really old. You know, it's 15 years old at this point.
Yeah.
And it's gotten to the point where it'll just hang up. It'll look fine. Like if you look at the screen, it looks fine.
But it's not.
But it's not passing any traffic anymore. And it'll hang up once a week, and I hit the reset button on it, and then it starts working. But I'm saying it's time to get that out of there.
Yeah. We just, we're upgrading our PFSense box to more network cards. So yeah. We did a self-build one. Ours is actually way overbuilt. it's got a 6-core with a couple of gigs of RAM. But there's a reason for it, and it's because one of the PFSense things I use is some of the NetFlow tools. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a fast enough processor, you're not using the NetFlow tools.
So, oh, yeah.
So I've got NetFlow and I got a few other things. Those little things, the processors, literally, they're so inexpensive. Mm-hmm. They had a sale at Micro Center. I was like, I paid $100 for the board and chip combo. It's like $98.
Oh.
I'm like, and then they had a RAM deal where it was like $20 for a few gigs of RAM. So that's what we built it on.
Yeah.
And we had literally laying around Velociraptor drives. So now that's what runs it. I was going to use an SSD, but we have Velociraptors, so
yeah, why not?
Yeah, why not? 10,000 RPM drives, because we turn on lots of logging, so we can just go through data tables, and mm-hmm. why not? Because I can.
Right. Very cool. I don't know what else is going on. I just at work. We're getting busy. We had this problem with our guest internet, and typically you would think your guest internet is it's not production, so it's not very important. You know, it's what do they call it? Best effort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, at the hospital, we consider it to be almost production because with guests and it's family members coming to see their family, and they need to get information out to the rest of their family. So we consider it to be very important. And then also doctors are getting on with their phones and stuff, and the doctors need to be able to get stuff done. So we had this issue on Friday. And we were troubleshooting it, going through all these things. End up being that Comcast was doing maintenance. And they sent the notice. They did send the notice, but it went to a different manager that used to be over network services and isn't anymore.
And he didn't think to tell someone.
Yeah, he didn't forward it on to us. And so we had spent probably 6 hours troubleshooting this.
Oh, man.
And then I was over. I stayed after, like an hour after I normally do. And then we finally get the message. Oh, yeah. He sent this over, and it's a Comcast thing.
So great. You guys actually have your network 100% segmented out. Like, that goes to Comcast, and business critical stuff runs over your standard fiber connections and everything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We have.
There's not even like a firewall that has a separate rule. It doesn't hit the same IP address.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Yeah, everything's tunneled out separate ways, and. Yeah.
It's part of the reason it's still going to be one central firewall, but we've thought about it just because the people bringing computers in, I look at it as a potential threat. It's not a separate network, but we thought about further separating some of that too. And mm-hmm. I like VLANs. I trust them mostly, but my tinfoil hat is instead of – I could split up to more VLANs or something, but we don't have any right now. We have physical separate switches.
Yeah.
And so when I'm adding another network, I needed more network cards in my PSNs because we're doing more physical separate switches. The fabric is completely isolated. That way I sleep better at night with that. Maybe I'm paranoid, but switches are cheap. So unmanaged switches, gigabit are – you know, decent ones are like $130.
Yeah.
I mean – get a VLAN switch, but what if someone jumps the VLAN and figures out a way to do that? It's not easy.
Right.
It's not an arbitrary hack, but it could happen.
It happens because of misconfigurations.
Yes.
It's not because of a flaw within the switch.
Yeah, the VLAN, it's not.
And in your situation, you guys are kind of a jack of all trades, so you're not an expert on Cisco switch
right.
security.
I don't want to worry about it. And, yeah, and if they're physically separated, there's never a question of did I plug it into the right port. Mm-hmm. Each switch is labeled to which network it belongs to. You plug it into the right network. So, yeah, that physical level of it. And the server door's locked, so someone only authorized to it. And I'm the only one who does that. So the other guys just use the network.
Right.
So, yeah, just keeping the tinfoil hat ready.
Sure.
Well, that's cool, though.
Yeah, so I think, I don't know, that's about it. Oh, we've had sickness going through my family.
I heard. I've seen that. See, this is where Facebook, that's why internet's important, because I've seen your wife post that you were sick and the kids were sick.
yeah, the bug flu, the 24-hour bug flu went through my kids and then me. And
children.
Yeah, and then right now they have, three of my kids have strep throat.
Oh.
And I went to get tested, and I'm a negative for strep.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, so I'm safe.
That's good. That's why you're here and talking on a microphone.
That's right. Yeah, otherwise I'd be home under a blanket or something.
I know. Tom would be solo because Phil is traveling today. So, and so is Mary.
Yeah, yeah. I think I know Mary. She keeps on talking about going again to
Iceland,
but I can never remember the dates that she's going.
Yeah, she's not here today, so she could be in another country.
She could be, yeah.
Phil is just in another state, so.
All right. I guess that's about it.
All right. So.
We want to hear from you. Call 734-258-7009 or email show@smlr.us with your feedback and questions.
I think people did email us at show@smlr.us. I'm pulling it up now.
That's right. Listener feedback. Do you remember Ken Cotton? Or Ken from Japan, I think is how he goes. He, we had met him, Mary and I met him at OLF last year. And OLF, Ohio Linux Fest.
Okay.
And he emailed back again that it reminded us that he works for an electronics manufacturer that actually makes those ALFA or Alpha network cards.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Working with. And they finally, at the time, last fall, they didn't have the Linux drivers built out to be able to do I think it's wireless sniffing or something to be in promiscuous mode, but he says they've got it working now.
Oh.
So I'm like,
Yeah, it works really well. I've been doing testing. It's been on my to-do list to a video. I did a fun – there's a Python script that kicks people off of Wi-Fi networks. You don't have to be connected to the network to make it work in the least.
Yeah.
It interrupts the 802.11w packets.
Yeah, it does. Is it DAuth?
DAuth. Yep.
Yeah,
it's a DAuth.
Yep.
So, yeah, I'm going to do a video on it, how it works, because it's kind of fascinating. There's not really any real protection from it. There's been a standard by which you can protect, but it's very, very not deployed, unsupported. Only very few networks use it. Like Cisco has an option for it, and Cisco to Cisco equipment. It's very obscure. It's been built into the Linux stack for a long time, but very few devices transmit the – all you're doing is the authorization packets go encrypted. Right now they're sent public. Now there's nothing in there that pertains to it. It's not like it's a hack to see it, but when you send the packet, it accepts in the clear, and it just removes you from the Wi-Fi and makes you reauthorize to it each time.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a super simple hack. It's a Python script that doesn't have any lines of code at all. You just send the packet.
Really?
That's all it does.
Holy cow.
The simplicity of it is why I find it fascinating.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I just can send these packets out to a MAC address. When the MAC address has to be the SSID, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be connected to it or anything. You just be in range of it. You send it, and anything that can listen just goes, oh, okay, I should send reauth, and it disconnects and tries to renegotiate. And if you flood it, nobody connects.
Yeah, you flood it. They try to reconnect, and then they're like, oh, wait, no, not supposed to reconnect yet.
Yep, not supposed to reconnect. It's still sending me deauth packets. It's not ready for authorization. So,
yeah, that's crazy. And so the downfall is that, like you said, it can run it against any you don't have to be connected or authenticated.
Yeah.
So an attacker can just walk into your building and start running that, and everybody
loses Wi-Fi.
Loses Wi-Fi.
Even if they've done encrypted, it'll shut out all your business Wi-Fis. It'll shut out everything.
Now, it only does it in the local area where that person's standing, like within the 300 feet or whatever where that person's standing is.
Yes.
So if you have a large enough building, it's only going to be localized to a section of that building.
Correct.
Where, so like at the hospital I work at, it would cause a problem. People would start complaining.
You
but
can
it wouldn't take down the entire hospital.
No.
Yeah.
No, because it doesn't bridge onto the network.
Exactly.
But if you put a Raspberry Pi with a bunch of these alphas on there and hid them places and turned them on randomly.
Yeah, if you put them in strategic locations.
You would have Tony chasing around the hospitals all day.
Yeah, it would make me very upset.
Don't worry, not doing that. That's highly illegal. We don't condone it. Yes. I've only drove my children crazy because it disconnects all their Chromecasts when I was testing it because I only targeted my house because I wanted to see how it worked. And they're like, Dad.
Yeah.
I wanted to see if it was working. You guys are all out of your bedrooms now. So, yes.
That may be a way to get your family together.
It is. If you want all the kids off the network, that's how I'll sell this. If you want all your kids off the network, run this script.
Right. It'll get them off their phone. It'll get them off.
It does. All of the things. Their tablets. They're like the kids with handfuls of devices coming out of their bedroom. Dad, what's going on?
I told you to stop. 10 minutes ago, and we were supposed to be out here. And
yeah, it's dinner time.
Exactly.
Well, actually, you know, I'll make one, call it the dinner bell, and leave it on my Linux server.
That's funny. What else do we have?
Well, so on. There is another one.
Melvin emailed us about FreeNAS 10, and so you've talked about your install. So thank you, Melvin, for reminding us that it was coming out.
Oh, yeah.
That was over a week ago.
Yep. And as soon as I'm done painting, I'll be doing more videos on it. So I'll be doing some follow-up.
Yep. I got an email from Eduardo. I think he sent it straight to me, not to the show. And he was asking about what was the travel website that I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to be able to book. And you're not going through a specific reseller or something. You can search all sites globally or all flights globally.
Oh,
and
okay.
It's called, it was the ITA Matrix.
Oh, cool.
And it's actually a Google software, or I guess a Google project of some sort. And you go through that, and then what's neat is once you find the flight you want, you can't book through that. But you go to it, and then you
have
copy. It gives you the itinerary. You copy that, like literally Control-A, copy, and then Control-C to copy it. And you paste that into another website. It's called Book with ITA or ITABooking.com or something. And when you paste it in there, it brings all that information in, and then it gives you the different websites to be able to book that flight through.
Oh,
so
cool.
Like it'll go through Priceline or something. And so it's neat. Or you can look at that and manually go to the...
Yeah, go to each one of the carriers. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
So he and I were emailing back and forth. And actually, he started emailing me back with GPG encrypted messages.
Oh, nice.
And it was just saying, hey, thanks, you know, so it wasn't a big thing. But I hadn't had anybody email me GPG in a long time, and I found out that I couldn't decrypt the message. I'm like, what's going on? I started digging through, and what happened when I exported it from my desktop and brought it to my laptop, my keys, I didn't export my private encrypt key correctly.
Oh.
So it didn't make it onto my laptop at all, so I couldn't decrypt it.
Ah.
So I had to go back to my desktop. I hadn't wiped it or anything.
Yeah.
And get the keys and move it over, and then it started working.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't have Signal loaded on your phone, by the way. You should load that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard good things about it, but I haven't used it.
Well, I'm going to let Phil, he's going to have a lot to say when he gets back.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, we'll talk about it because it was a new job and everything else, but he has become an encryption nut. So.
Wow.
Well, I think he was already, so I can't say become, but he's making me one too. So me and Phil, he was hanging out with me, Friday? No, Thursday. He was over hanging out with me Thursday or Friday, so.
Oh, yeah.
But that's the only way he'll talk to me is that everything has to be an encrypted channel, he said.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, it all has to do with his new job. That he can't, he's under NDA to actually talk, I'll tell you about it offline, but he can't talk about it, and I'm not going to say anything about it other than that. So.
Sure.
I can tell you what he's allowed to say, but I'm not going to say it on air.
That's neat.
But it's really cool because it's going to be really interesting because he's going to have stories about it. So
nice. We got an email from Julian. And I remember Julian emailing us quite a while ago. Julian suggested a some music to listen to.
Yeah, I've seen that.
The Leopard Girl. So I unfortunately have been busy and haven't been able to listen to it. It's like I can get it on my phone, but then I didn't click on it right or something. Or the freearchive.org website wasn't working on my phone right that one day. But hey, I'm going to trust that he knows what he's doing. And
yeah.
We'll go and play it.
We'll just play it.
That's right. Did you see anything else?
Nope, that was the last one from Julian.
All right. You know, I haven't logged into the website yesterday. Have you seen any, you didn't see any messages?
I did not log in.
Okay. All right, then I guess we are going to continue on.
Distro Fever, where we cover the latest hot distro releases and news.
All right.
And right at the top of the list, something I just mentioned earlier, Proxmox.
Hey, updates.
Yes. Yeah, that's the virtual system, and we talked about just at the beginning of the show. It's really cool, and it, like I said, FreeNAS 10 is what made me think about this. I was excited with FreeNAS 10, and I'm realizing it's not as polished, but I love where they're going with it. But Proxmox said that they've been there for a while with the convergence of a ZFS file system with a rate virtualization that competes with maybe on the same level of ESX, but it's kind of like that. It's got some really high-end features, so...
Yeah, yeah, and this is the Proxmox 5 beta version,
yeah,
which is based on the new Debian 9 stretch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, like you said, it's similar to VMware.
Yeah.
And I remember my friend talking about he can move VMs from one server to another. And so if you have maintenance to do on your server, physical maintenance, yep, you can move them all over to a different server, shut down that server, do whatever maintenance, and then bring it back up and then move the
That's really back. Impressive. And, you know, like I said, I looked at Proxmox a long time ago, and it's kind of on the back burner when I realized that they had gotten to that level of functionality. They also, if I'm not mistaken, they support HA, where you can keep them on both servers at the same time and have a failover. I'm like, you know, I haven't read into the details about that, but it looked like the one of the features it had. I'm like, wow.
Hmm.
I mean, that's, for an open source project, that's outstanding.
Yeah.
And very, very important. And it runs Windows really well, which is important because some people have that need to run Windows and VMs for certain things they do, like us. We run Linux, but we have to run Windows VMs because some of the tools we use to manage our clients because, well, we fix Windows all day. So sometimes we need a Windows box to fix a Windows box. Mm-hmm. We also do testing in Windows, and VMs are the way to do that.
Do you know what it uses as the hypervisor?
KVM.
Is it KVM?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Which KVM is a very good hypervisor.
Sure is.
The Beehive one for FreeBSD that FreeBSD 10 is on is a little weird, and I had a hard time getting Windows running in it. It just feels like everything's under development. Runs Linux fine. It runs containers fine. So it ran Docker really well, but it runs things in that nature no problem. But it seems to have little issues. I couldn't get Windows running on it, and other people seem to have the same problem. But in the demo of FreeNAS, they had it running. So, but it uses like a weird. I don't know if it's actually called, Phil said it looked like a tool called Guacamole. I think that's what he said, that runs it because you can view the terminal inside the browser, but it's very unpolished. And you have to use UEFI to even make it work, which is weird. You have to load, even to Linux, if you want a graphical interface, you have to load UEFI on it. And it's there's a lot that's of weirdness. Versus this
mean?
Is...
What do you mean load UEFI?
When you're building the VM, you have to choose a UEFI boot system in order to get any graphics on it. If not, it actually connects to a serial console, which is weird.
Really?
That's the other option when you don't use it. So if you want to use a Grub loader or the Beehive loader, it has a serial interface that it goes, that it wraps into the terminal. It's just, let's just say it doesn't feel polished. It's neat. I love the concept of it. But then when I looked at Proxmox, I'm like, they solved all this. Like, why not just copy what they did? Like, they have QEMU. It's like their whole system looks like really polished when I was watching all the demos of it. I'm like, okay, this is what it could be. And I just didn't realize how far along Proxmox was. I mean, I looked at it a long time ago, years ago, and before I built PHP VirtualBox. I've been running that for a long time. You do too. You run that too, don't
you? Yeah, I run it right now. And that's what I want to replace that with the FreeNAS.
Take a look at Proxmox, though. I won't lie.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I want something that'll do – well, like you said, Proxmox will do it where I want something that'll do the FreeNAS-like stuff with ZFS.
Yeah.
But then run VMs on it also.
Right. And the only thing I don't, and I got to learn this about Proxmox, I love VirtualBox because of the way I can transport a virtual machine anywhere into an OVF file. Mm-hmm. Because I build them, like I build them on my desktop, play around with them. Okay, this one's ready for service, and I can just deploy it. And I do that at home. I do that at my, because I'm running PeachWorks, just import the file, done. Nice. No thoughts to it. Easy to export and transport it somewhere else. Matter of fact, because we back up to OVF files, I can spin it up on another server in no time at all. It just has to have VirtualBox on it. You can grab my laptop, load my whole point of sale system on it by importing the OVF file and done.
Yeah.
You know, I can't.
That's where Proxmox will do that for you, too. You can do easy export and import stuff.
Right.
But you have to have the same, probably KVM running on your desktop.
You have to have KVM running on it versus there is no I couldn't find it, at least. I don't have an export option in FreeNAS.
Really?
And it's all in Beehive, which is very new and not as popular of a VM. Mm. Even the instructions of how to take one of my virtual machines out of VirtualBox and get it in there, not arbitrary. Lots of work.
Oh, man. There's That's just, what I'm worried about.
It's no import.
Huh.
They don't have an import option at all.
Yeah.
So I have to do a bare metal backup.
I was going to say do the
– start a VM and do a bare metal restore. That's that's the only easy way to do it. Doing it from the file level, there's so much conversions that it's stupid.
Wow.
Yeah. The containers don't translate into raw file at all, so you have to – the ZFS containers they use for the file system, which is also one of my rants going, why not build an import? So this should be in the GUI. But then again, they don't even have replacing a hard drive in the GUI, so one step at a time.
That's right.
Anyways, let's look at the other distros.
Let's see. We have Nutix is on here. That's a development release. There's just a lot of development this time.
Beta 2 Ubuntu.
Yeah. If you're going to PenguinCon at the end of April, they will be doing...
Release party.
Yeah, the release party. And they do it every year.
Yeah.
Release parties at the end of April. So the 1704, come join us. I'll be there for a little bit. There's a key signing party that runs about the same time. So I might run and do that first and then come over.
Yeah, they always coincide them, and I want to do both.
Yeah.
So...
good thing that the release party is more of just people hang out and filter in and out, so it's not a big deal to be late.
Yeah. I like talking to a bunch of developers.
Yeah.
You get to hear it from the horse's mouth. I want to know what's going on. What do you like about ZFS, ButterFS? You know, that conversation I had with them last year, I think it was great. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was enlightening. I didn't realize how much the Ubuntu team prefers ZFS.
Oh yeah,
yeah. He said I'm unofficially speaking for Ubuntu, so don't quote me on this. I know everyone's talking about ButterFS, but we really like ZFS.
Yeah,
and because they were at Michael Lucas's talk.
Oh, okay.
And they were singing praises of him and his talk, and yeah,
that's cool.
Which I am too. ZFS is a pretty impressive system. So
yeah, I do see Plamo. Is it Plamo? I think Plamo Linux 6.2. And that's based on Slackware.
Yeah, Japanese.
Yeah.
Language Slackware. Very cool. Rockstore looks kind of neat. I have not played with that. That's another Linux-based NAS box. I tell you what, the graphics are really pretty on it.
I don't even see that on the list.
Really? It's on there. Hmm. It's just under a bunch of...
Oh, it's down further.
Yeah,
okay.
Down further.
Yeah, I see. Oh, yeah. Hmm.
Do I see the word ZFS in there? I do not. Maybe. I'll have to go to their website.
Yeah.
There's a concept that, you know, I because it's open source, it doesn't bother as much. I'm very much not for everything jumping onto one system.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, we love diversity in any of the ecosystems, whether it's because we rely on one single desktop unit or whatever. I love the diversity across Linux. I do say a lot and preach a lot for ZFS because I've used it so much and dealt with it. And because it's open source and free, I don't mind that a lot of people use it.
Yeah.
It does have some advantages over Extent 4, so. But then someone did decide to develop it. It was an announcement in Reddit. Someone's developing another file system.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Really? That's what we need, right?
Right.
He's fine. I forget. It does something that ZFS doesn't. I don't remember what it was now. I was just like. I don't want to poo-poo that. I'm great because but it's incredibly complicated. It's kind of like, let's reinvent security. This whole key exchange thing is hard. Yeah, that's because it works. It
just, right. All right.
And of course, FreeNAS 10. We're not going to talk about it, but that's on this list too.
Yeah, very nice. All right. So we're good to go.
Tech news and views.
So where do we want to start?
All right. If you want to go ahead and start off and okay. then I'll follow up.
Netflix finally adds support for Firefox on Linux. Some people know this is already supported if you lied about the user agent.
Mm-hmm.
But it's official now. Netflix said we can officially do it, which Ooh. Is – that's the big change. Not that it's been supported on air, but yeah. This made me laugh, and this is an old bug. Did you know there was a bug in XFCE that can physically destroy the screen?
No.
Yes. And it's just great how this goes. I'm smiling and laughing. I'm going to leave a link to the bug in the show notes. So it's right on the Bugzilla for XSE.org. And a user reported that his screen was destroyed because of a bug. And the bug was the little mouse picture. His cat destroyed his screen by scratching it.
Why?
And developers didn't delete the bug. They said, okay, we'll change it to a dog to chase the cat away. Boom. They got a great sense of humor. I love that. That made me laugh a lot. I think that's in the comment replies. We'll change it to a dog. Just
wow.
We solved the bug. And I'm like, they're not wrong. Nobody's wrong in this. Yes, it destroyed the screen. Yes, it's an XSE bug. And yes, they solved the problem. Bug closed. just genius. Now, this goes back to my hate for clickbait. Microsoft loves Linux so much, OneDrive web app runs like a dog on non-Windows computers. Now, that's how it was titled over on the Register, and they're kind of right, kind of wrong. So, yes, it was a bug that it turns out if you had Linux on your computer and you didn't lie about the user agent, OneDrive wouldn't work properly, the web interface, and it would go super, super slow. Then there was a response on Y Combinator. Both these links will be in the show notes. Basically, it says, we identified that the static load.aspx page that prefetches in the background for Office Online apps was using the link prefetching browser mechanism for only certain platforms. So basically, it was a background loader and on there, but it identified the user agent to understand which prefetch link to use, and they simply omitted the entry for Linux. Now, they apologized and said this was not done on purpose. It was just we only when we built the array essentially put these user agents in there, like, you know, Windows 7, Windows 10 type things, and didn't add Linux.
Sure.
Yeah. So Microsoft apologized for it, said exactly what was going on, said they did it, and said it was an oversight. I don't know. I would say that Microsoft doesn't think about Linux users would be a pretty good thing. Pretty good thing to say and accurate to say, but I don't think it was a conspiracy like to negate Linux users. I think it was yeah, that's right, you guys are out there.
Yeah.
I know we have this Azure thing that runs a lot of Linux stuff, but so I don't think there was malicious intent. I think there was like, you're only about 5% of the world, so, or less than that on a desktop, so yeah.
Right.
I feel more is like that. We didn't think we'd write the code for it. This was an interesting article on the OMG Ubuntu is, has popularity peaked for Ubuntu? And I get where they're coming from on it because it's actually kind of true. Ubuntu's become boring. And the reason why, and it's the reason why I use it, is also the reason why it's boring. It just works out of the box. I honestly spend so little time with Ubuntu doing anything custom. Like, I used to have custom scripts to fix dumb stuff all the time.
Yeah.
Like, change this setting, change this thing, compile this into the kernel, use this add-on driver. I literally load Ubuntu and it works out of the box. And because of that, I like it because I have work to get done. I have other distros I play with all the time, but my production machines, I've been running Ubuntu on them because it just works. So they're kind of right. And it's causing, because they're very code stable / they're not doing major interface revisions. They're very slow incremental over the time that there's not this big excitement when Ubuntu 17.04 comes out. They're like, it doesn't really make it look different. You didn't break everything for me to talk about it. So, right.
I guess when you're looking at popularity, what is the metrics? You know, are they looking at how much are people talking about on social media?
Yes, and that's kind of what they're talking about. It doesn't get the fanfare now, and that could be what slows down growth, is because it doesn't get talked about as much. It's a weird perspective to look at, but I think it's worth thinking about. But I don't know. It's actually, to me, it's an easy sell for Ubuntu because of the consistent look it has. even if you don't like that look, you're like, well, I know exactly where everything is. I know what to expect. I know when I load it on my laptop, it's going to work out of the box. I'm going to be able to get right to the thing I need to get done, which is because I'm using it for my production life. You know, I don't have time for – because one of the problems I ran into, like the when they constantly are changing the libraries, like the dispute with the MLT libraries, all of a sudden my video editing software didn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I need to edit a video. I have a video to publish. We got time schedules to keep. And, oh, I can't publish it until someone solves this problem. I have to post it to a forum, wait for them to update it. And then this is because back in Ubuntu 12, there was a dispute with which library to use or something stupid. Yeah. And I'm like, ah. So I then had to go download the libraries manually, and it took me 2 hours to get them all compiled properly. I really just want to edit a video sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, just it's like the amount of level of work. I'm like, this is my commitment to Linux. I'm willing to spend 2 hours compiling a library so I can edit a video that's only 6 minutes long.
Yeah.
I could just switch to Windows where it's code stable, which I'm never going to do. But I mean, that's kind of when you look at it, going, I need something that is somewhat code stable so I can get work done. So I don't know. That's an interesting thought. More Vault 7. So you've seen the Cisco ones. Do you guys do some updates to Cisco?
No, we have our system. Our management realm for all of our stuff is so locked down that...
Telnet's disabled, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and if you're not in certain VLANs, you can't connect to the management IPs and things like that. So you would have to get through like many layers of security before you can even try to break brute force our equipment.
That's kind of what I had commented, that any sysadmin with Assault in 2017 has locked down ACLs on Telnet or disabled Telnet altogether because of, you know, other management tools they've got on there. You know what I mean? Like, you've locked it down. It only accepts connections from certain spots. So I see it as a vulnerability. I'm glad they're fixing it. It was a big hole. But the other side of that coin is if you don't have that locked down, if you got it just open on a network at any given time, it's Telnet.
That's bad. Telnet in general is bad. You should always disable that and use SSH instead.
Yep. Oh, the Cisco or something. I'm not a big Cisco guy, but I mean, they pretty much all ship with SSH now, don't they?
Oh yeah, yeah. Anything in the last 10 years has been SSH.
Yeah. So I mean, available. You probably disable Telnet and just use SSH for everything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have some stuff that is over 10 years old that we have to use Telnet for that until we get it updated or get it replaced. And in those cases, we do have even higher security, like ACLs that were only like 3 IP addresses can connect to it.
Yeah.
So you have to get to a jump box that can connect to it and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a proper way to do it. So another piece of Vault 7 was interesting was a tool called Dark Matter. And it was really clever. And it's one of those, you know, you'd think, remember a story we read probably in school about a Trojan horse being delivered?
Yeah.
So basically, they would gift infected laptops to people they had as high value targets.
Really?
They would get them. And this is where there's a grandstanding by WikiLeaks, like, oh no, they had infiltrated the supply chain. No, they didn't. They literally bought them, infected them, and gifted them. That happens. It is simple as that. They backdoored them and then gifted these devices to people or gave them as bribes. And somehow they got them in their possession, like a great deal on a MacBook type thing to the high value targets they were looking for. So they had that on there. Yeah, that was interesting.
That's interesting.
Did you follow up with any of the Yahoo stuff and seeing that the indictments?
No.
So they've now indicted, and no shocker, the way that these guys got in Yahoo and compromised half a billion accounts, spear phishing. They spear phished to sysadmins. So it was a very targeted attack. It appears as though there was some nation state sponsored actors, but there was specific targets.
Is that Yahoo saying it was nation state?
Yes. Indirectly, there was a hacker group that was apparently, they alleged, supported by Russia.
You know my theory behind that is? If they want to sound like we're really strong, but nobody can defend up against the nation state.
Yeah.
Then obviously the only person that can attack them is the nation state.
Yeah.
So that's what they're going to say.
Yeah.
Likely it could have been anybody. They just screwed up.
They detailed it that the basically they spearfished the sysadmins, and it gets even funnier though. Or sad. Okay, funny, sad. I don't know. Pick one depending on the mood you're in. They spearfished them. They got the account system. They wandered around the account. They understood the logging system in Yahoo so well that they created a tool that automatically wiped the tracks of them. So the logging system carried on, but it didn't log what these guys did. Then they were able to log in and craft cookies. So instead of password resets, they could craft session cookies so they could just log in and be you. Then they got a step further. Oh, this is where it gets even crazier. Instead of using Yahoo's system to craft a session cookie so they could have a persistent login to your account, they learned how to do it without Yahoo on their own internal network. So really? They could just become any person's Yahoo without knowing their password by creating a session cookie, dropping it on their computer, and they'd be at all your Yahoo services as if you were logged in.
So there's some kind of algorithm that Yahoo's been using.
And they figured it out.
That's predictable.
It's predictable. And, they had to have the inside server information to create it. So it took inside info, so it wasn't externally doable. But apparently the FBI let them know that there was targets within there, which included journalists and all kinds of people that used Yahoo. So they didn't have it just for funsies and the lulls. They got in there with a target list. Or it could be that they got in there and then they sold target lists to other places. None of that's ever going to be clear. They're all non-extradition. They're not – yeah. They're not going to catch these guys anytime soon coming to the U.S. and picking them up. But it occurred. Travis Ormandy, the genius that he is, found another hole in LastPass.
Yeah,
and it's
Remember, who's Travis?
He is the Project Zero researcher who's been let's see.
Project Zero is at Google.
Yes. Right. Did we talk about Cloudbleed last time?
We did.
Yes. Yep. He is also the one who found Cloudbleed. And I think we talked about the Nintendo music file libraries that would do that. All three of those are Tavis. The guy is a super genius. And right now he's poking holes in something as we speak, I'm sure. I mean, the guy's like in his early 20s and just he finds the most obscure bugs that require not just vulnerabilities. They require threat stacking to be able to, you know, the level of things. It blows my mind that he comes up with. Yeah. But he's also kind of a smartass, I guess you could say, because I think he posted a picture on his Twitter of him – a Simpsons picture walking around and getting hit in the face with rakes. And it's like me finding bugs in LastPass and he keeps getting hit with them because he found more than one. Really? So he is a little bit of a – but I you know what? I don't blame him. He's a super genius and he's finding stuff and he's not wrong about what he's finding. But on the LastPass hack, his details are very accurate. LastPass has a hilarious – well, they screwed up too. They couldn't make his proof of concept work. And he kind of called them nitwits. He goes, really, guys? I told you and sent you a screenshot that you can execute binaries. I can open calc.exe. They tried out with a Mac. And he looked at his logs. He goes, you're trying with a Mac. It won't execute calc.exe because it doesn't exist. And he put that in the comments. LastPass fixed the bug really fast. What it is, in the JavaScript manifest file, there is a site. And that site will accept all kinds of data from LastPass. It says SSL, so that's not where the problem is. It does so unsigned. That's where kind of the problem is. It doesn't require an SSL, but it will do so unsigned. So if someone wanted to send a binary down there, they can tell it to do whatever they want or script. It takes controls. But this is where the threat stacking comes along. First, you have to spoof the site. You have to spoof the LastPass site. Then, which means you've compromised your computer's DNS. Then you have to spoof the SSL. Then, only then, you also have to have the binary side of the LastPass loaded, which by default it's not if you're just using the browser extension. So you got to load the extra binaries as well. Then it works. So yes, it's a serious hack. And I did a video called LastPass is Hacked, but why I'm still using it is because, one, once you've compromised my DNS and can spoof an SSL, you're going to create more problems than just this one little code base. I think it should be fixed. I'm glad they fixed it. I'm glad they fixed it fast.
Right.
But that level of threat stacking and the fact that I don't run the binary version because I'm just running a browser extension in Linux and not actually the downloaded version of LastPass means it's a serious threat, but it's a non-trivial threat. So that's – and I hate all the headlines, LastPass this, LastPass failed, blah, blah, blah. Everyone panic and, fire in the sky is falling. And I'm like, no – if you've already had your DNS compromised, there's not really a workaround even LastPass has for this. If you spoof Twitter and you spoof the SSL for Twitter, it will then put the password in as if it's Twitter. That's not a flaw in LastPass. That means your computer was compromised. So anyone who can do DNS spoofing and SSL spoofing already can get all of your passwords. Granted, it's one at a time. Yes, they can. Once you're man in the middle, you're kind of – well, you're man in the middle. You're going to give up your passwords either by them watching – because if you can spoof an IP address, and spoof the SSL, you're in anyways.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And my last story is, Google Chrome. They've had enough of Symantec shenanigans and poor security, and they're not allowed to issue SSL certs anymore.
Really? Google
is taking down a CA.
Wow.
Not the associations. Google says Chrome's not going to trust Symantec CA. That's like a line in the sand. Now, no one else has followed suit. Explorer and Firefox still plan to keep them in as a CA, but this is pretty big because Chrome has the majority market share, and we're saying we're not going to trust your CA because our investigation – and I think there's a personal note to this that Symantec, because of the way they're – they don't certify properly like you're supposed to for a proper high-level SSL cert, people were able to spoof Google. And they were able to get Symantec to issue a cert for Google. So They're like – and they gave them chances. It's not like one time Google went and audited them. Google's audited them multiple times, and Symantec keeps failing in a different way.
Hmm.
And they're blatant oversights, not even logs as to how – you're able to issue Google. And then they fixed it, and then they found out there was a workaround for it where you could backdate SSL certs. They found so many flaws in it. And every time they've approached them and done disclosure, they don't fix it. They just keep doing the same thing over again. So it's like one of those things like, look, we're just going to – until you guys figure out how to do security, Symantec, we're just going to turn this off.
Wow.
So everyone's in a total panic attack over it because so many companies have an automated systems that – use that as a URL generation system and update their certs and gets tied in to that. But that's also where all the flaws are.
So are they doing their typical, like they won't trust any new certs from Symantec or is it?
They're giving them so many days before they're stopping it. There's a bunch of – there seems to be a couple updates on the story. There's going to be like an escalation of downgrades. I think there's no more new ones is for sure. But they're going to keep trusting the old ones for so long. That way it just doesn't break the internet. They want to give people an opportunity to do something, and they're hoping Symantec notifies people that they're not allowed to have CAs from them anymore. So it's going to be this big
– yeah.
Because the customers are going to be the victims of this because now they're going to have to buy a CA. Will Symantec redo it, or Symantec say, look, any of your users in Chrome are just going to get an error? which one is it? It's a mess. It's a big mess. Just use Let's Encrypt, folks. It's safer. I think that's the end of my stories list I had.
So the difference between Let's Encrypt and some of the other CAs is that Let's Encrypt will only do domain validation
ones. They won't do the EV certs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or organizational.
Or organizational ones. So if you need a higher level cert for selling, you're going to need something better. But they're not trusting all the Symantec ones down the pipe. And I know some of them are just, I think, validation certs.
Yeah.
Just so people have SSL on different subdomains and things like that when they want to log into things.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a mess. It's a big, big mess.
Jeez.
That's I don't know what they're gonna do. But I like Google for doing it. I gotta say, I don't look at Google and they're wrong. I mean, you can't have that many flaws. You're not trustworthy. You're the Hong Kong Post problem we've talked about a couple times. I mean, it's you can't have an untrustworthy. Someone did suggest, and I guess there's some tools out there that people have been working on to re-edit your list of trusted CAs so you can just take some of them out. Because there's been other times when I've talked about Chinese CAs running on the edge of quality.
Yeah.
And that is kind of scary that they're out there like that.
Yeah, it's been over, in the last 5 or 10 years that list of CAs have really exploded.
That's the problem.
Where before there was a set of 10 or 20 like really good trusted CAs. And then all of a sudden, Internet Explorer started adding in and adding in more and more. And I guess not doing the proper background checks or
pretty much
or not following up after they've been certified.
Yeah. And CA, in case anyone doesn't know, is a certificate authority. And they're the ones who do they verify that I am Tom Lawrence and that I own a website and that I am really a real person. They actually go through several steps. If you buy a selling CA one, that would be the EV cert. What's the higher level one called for selling? Is it?
I'm not sure about that. I think it's EV, extended validation.
Yeah, extended validation. They vet me. They want my driver's license number. They go through an actual process to identify that I'm a real human being operating a website before I can sell things on it. So they've got some things they do, and that is non-trivial. And I did it years ago. It was really hard to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've made it easier, but when you want some of the higher end search like that, it's there's some effort that goes into it. I mean, my driver license is floating out there somewhere. I had to do it for a client.
Oh, yeah.
They just wanted it done, and I said, fine. I put myself on there. They just want everything to be SSL. They weren't even selling anything. They just wanted all SSL for all things.
Yeah. And that's where now Let's Encrypt is awesome for that kind of thing.
Yep. Because we use Let's Encrypt in my office for things. We just want it encrypted. It's not – there's really nothing super critical. It's like – I mean, there's a customer name in there, but there's not any personal – other personal identification. But we went ahead and set it all up. You know, it's one of those – because I can.
Right.
And that's a wonderful thing about Let's Encrypt. It's because if you can encrypt it and make it easy and everyone encrypt things.
Exactly.
Like me.
Nice. Speaking of Let's Encrypt, I've got an article from Bleeping Computer, mm-hmm. and it says 14,766 Let's Encrypt SSL certificates issued to PayPal phishing sites. So there's a debate going around like this, where Let's Encrypt, a CA, are they there to just issue certificates?
Right.
And Let's Encrypt specifically is good because it's an automated system.
Yes.
You know, anybody can get it. It's free to get. And so it's nice, you know, people running their own servers at home or whatever can get certificates, and it's affordable. So the problem now is people running phishing sites can also get them.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, does the CA supposed to sit there and for domain validation, are they supposed to say, well, we're only going to allow these people and not others? You know, are they supposed to be doing content filtering, you know, based on the content of their website or something?
Right. I'm of the opinion they shouldn't.
Right.
It's a slippery slope.
I am also. But I think that there's some top-level domains that are very popular that shouldn't be done. So I would say they should have a short blacklist saying we're not going to give it for these ones that include these names, but anything else is fine.
Yeah, but that becomes so hard to do because there's so many typos and misspellings, and then you end up flagging with that regular expression you come up with that filters it. You end up flagging legit people who then get angry that their Let's Encrypt doesn't work. It's just, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if that I'm right or wrong. I won't lie. I'm on the fence on it.
And so what this is, what we're referring to is, phishing sites, you know, is websites that look like PayPal, and the URL will be something like paypal.ca.us.cz or something, you know, so you'll see PayPal on there, or you'll see, it'll look very, or pay.pal, you know, and it'll be, it'll look like a PayPal sign and a site. And what they're doing is they're trying to steal your credentials. So most people look at it and say, oh, it's a secure website. Oh, it's got to be PayPal, you know, and they're not, the average Joe isn't looking at it enough. Well, the issuance of these or people requesting these certs have just exploded in the last few months. Like since October, somewhere in October, they passed the 1,000 mark of certs. And then all the way up through February, now they're over 5,000 certs.
Wow.
So that's where I think it's a per month. Yeah, per month that it's being issued. So it's really just increased a lot. It's like some of them are paypal.com.logmyaccount.policy.country.
Yeah.
You know, and somebody will see that PayPal at the beginning and think the rest of it is a login policy thing and just, oh, whatever. And those are, you know, it's just, I'm torn because I agree with you that it shouldn't be a content filtering base, but this is also, you know,
it's clearly issued for the purpose of phishing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know it's such a tough thing. So I've read some stories on it. And I'm just like, where do I fall on this?
Right. And because they're so easy to spin up, and that was a subdomain. So you don't have to buy a new domain to get it and stuff, that it's easy to spin up one of these. And so to have a blacklist of phishing like websites, you know, is very hard. It has to be.
It's well, and once you start down there, then anytime one gets through, they say you didn't do enough. You didn't do enough. Let's encrypt. You didn't filter enough. You didn't.
Oh, yeah.
So now are you the, you know, like, well, we did it because someone asked us to. Now we did it. Now we can't do it enough. Now we have to hire another team just to manage regular expressions to figure out what is and what isn't a phishing site.
Yeah.
One of the things that the software we use for the our managed services software that does the web filtering, you may not download executables at all without an SSL. And that was at least one easy way to say if it's not SSL and it's not executable, it probably is a virus or something.
Yeah.
Well, since then, it's become less effective simply because they're all got Let's Encrypt ones on there.
Yeah.
So, but then again, the nice thing is because it's one CA, I think, and I got to talk to the people behind the magic because we don't get to write the rules. We have to deal with the rules. We can add certain exceptions, but we don't actually get to write the rules. But I'm hoping they wrote a rule that says you can't download executables from a Let's Encrypt, maybe. I don't know. That would be a way to do it. But it would also break things for me because, like, our remote tool is Screen Connect, and it downloads an executable off of a Let's Encrypt.
Yeah.
See, and that's one of the reasons we encrypted it, even though we know it's our executable. That's one of the reasons we encrypted it. It is downloading executable, so it could be man in the middle. That's why we switched to it. That's all it's for, though. It's not any personal user information on there, but you are downloading something from our site to get your tools started for your remote session. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why I said there's so many. It could break something for me that I'm using for basic protection. Then maybe I should buy a better SSL. I mean, because like I said, I'm not selling anything. I'm just doing it to have it encrypted. Because it's really weird. Out of the box, the Screen Connect company doesn't have encryption on it.
Oh, yeah.
Which I thought was weird. I mean, all the transport layers are encrypted and everything else is. But the actual download for executable just runs a standard port 80 web server.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we wrapped it in Apache to secure it.
Nice.
They do have a process by which you can install one into the software itself. It's not arbitrary. So people like my work instruction of wrapping it through Apache because it's super simple. And wrapping it themselves doesn't support Let's Encrypt. Apache does.
Hey, yeah.
So.
All right. I found an article about creating it's called a handheld Linux PC that it's actually a Raspberry Pi
with an
iPhone keyboard.
Isn't that sweet?
Slide out. It is really cool. And so what it is you can get a physical keyboard for an iPhone. And what it does, there's like a case that goes around your iPhone. And then you turn it sideways and it slides out, just like the old slider, like texting phones.
Yeah.
And then you have a little chiclet keyboard sitting there.
It's pretty cool. And that's on n-o-d-e.net. That guy does some amazing projects. I check him out. His YouTube channel combined with the documentation, and I love the style he does things in.
Yeah. So he used a Raspberry Pi 0W. So it's the new one with the wireless and the Bluetooth built in. The keyboard itself is Bluetooth. And what it is he took the case and then created, did a 3D print.
Yeah, 3D print.
Top,
to hold it.
To hold it, yeah. And then it's a screen in there. And what's really cool about it is it opens up. If you're walking around with it, holding and using it, all it is the terminal. You get like a bash prompt. But then as soon as you set it down and you plug in to an HDMI and USB, it brings up a full desktop.
Which is just really slick.
Yeah. So you can have a separate keyboard and mouse and you can be doing your regular stuff, but then when you're going to go, then you've got your Linux terminal that you can do stuff with.
I follow that guy's YouTube channel because his projects are cool.
Yeah,
and well documented.
Yeah, and then also with being wireless, you get the IP address, you can SSH into it, and use it as a little.
And I imagine you'd have to use a self powered hub, but you could get hardware networking by plugging into the USB on it. You just have to use a self powered hub because the Raspberry Pi won't power a USB network adapter.
Yep.
But nonetheless, it's a pretty amazing little tool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty cool. And there's a little video about how he did it and stuff. It's really neat.
Yeah. No, I that was definitely slick.
Mm-hmm. And then the last article I have. Actually, I found more throughout the week, but for some reason I saved it in the wrong place, and now I can't find it.
This is why Tom had to change his workflow for notes.
Right. It's in Gadget. wrote an article about how to adult at security. So how to be an adult with security.
Well.
And
it's actually the kids that seem more secure, but okay.
Right.
I get the premise.
It says, stop using the same password for everything. Seriously, your cat's name followed by your birth date isn't fooling anybody. Don't be that guy who totally gets owned by ransomware and goes on. And it goes through and talks about a lot of the most popular ways to get security hacked and stuff. And you need to, you know, watch what you're doing. Use a password manager, you know?
Yeah.
And
use LastPass, use, was it 1Password?
Yeah. 1Password is what they suggested too, but, I really like LastPass. Yeah. I use it also. And, seriously, that's the way to go because I don't know any of my passwords anymore. I know my 1LastPass password.
Yep.
Everything else is a long, and unique password for every system I use.
Yeah, and what was it, a couple episodes ago, we talked about, in Fresh Looks, talked about securing things and turning off SSH, except for key-only authentication. I mean, there's just step-by-step-by-step, there's things you can do. We have it at, four episodes ago now.
It was a while ago, yeah.
Read through our episodes.
4 episodes was 2 months ago, so it was probably about that.
Yeah, but we've done some of this work. We talk about things you can do to lock down your Linux boxes. Please don't just have simple passwords.
Yes,
that's exactly the first step in adulting.
Yeah. Don't use a 4-character password.
No.
You know, it goes on. There's things that they talk about doing, like surveillance and how to use Signal or Threema for encrypted password or encrypted communication. You know, things that there's a book. It says OPSEC for Activists. Is it a book or something? But
read Cory Doctorow's books.
Yeah.
I mean, my daughter has read them. She's like, it really changed her perspective on how she thinks about security and the government and everything else. It's the books are so good.
That's cool.
Those guys at Google, they were talking about encryptions between their private links between their data center. Mm-hmm. And when I asked them why they did it, they said, Cory Doctorow's book, both of us have read it. They were doing an interview and they said that. And they were like, wow. And then it turned out later that NSA, one of the approaches they had when Stone released was that they were trying to tap the data center interlinks, which are supposed to be, you know, private links between two companies. And they said, well, we decided to encrypt them because we were afraid the government might do that. Turns out the government was doing that.
Right. You know, I was thinking about that at work. You know, should we be doing that? And it might be a good thing, you know, but it's not we're not hiding stuff from it. From the government.
No, you actually are turning it all over to the government. But.
Yeah, exactly. our threat model is a little bit different than what Google has. But.
Yeah, but you still could have a bad actor at AT&T's fiber link center in the data center that decides to tap a link in between there.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's crazy, but we've seen crazy. That's the threat models are real.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so yeah, that's where that was the articles I found so far.
It's funny I skipped over it, but I had that Node one in there because I watched it. I follow the guy on YouTube, so when he has new stuff that comes out like that, that's really cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool.
I like his black and white style he does everything in, like kind of text graphics. I mean, look him up. It's really neat. It'll be in the show notes.
What is the Node is his blog.
Yep. And it's node-o-d-e.net.
Yeah.
It's all dashed out like that. But it's, I like him. That's, by the way, even though this is a blog, SSL, you know, what certificate does he use? I wonder. Is he using actual bot certificate or is it Let's Encrypt? Learn more. Site settings. Whoops.
Isn't there with you're supposed to click something else? Is it
they moved it?
Control E or something to I found it the other day. Now I can't. Anyway, so dead air. Nice.
Dead air. Yeah. Oh, there we go. View certificate. It's Control Shift I.
Oh yeah. Inspect.
Oh, he's got rapid SSL. So he cares that you read his blog encrypted.
That's right.
Which is good. I like that. Because I have not done that to my blog. I don't post much on it.
Yeah. So what we're talking about is recently Chrome changed it where you can't just click on a little certificate or lock and see information about the cert itself.
Yeah.
You have to click or hold down Control and Shift.
And I.
And I for to inspect the certificate.
Yep.
And then it gives you all the information.
They just moved it on you and it's kind of, whatever.
Yeah.
We don't like change. Don't move things on us. We can't deal with this. We need everything to be the same.
Right.
We're like old graybeards, and this is how things need to be now.
It's actually part of the
The whole
development tools or the console, tools. And it's just the last one, the security. Mm-hmm. So if you do F12 and then go to the security tab on that.
Matter of fact, if you're a fan of Chrome, it gives you a lot of really cool information too.
It does. Yeah, I've used it a lot when I'm like trying to figure out why a website that I'm working on is broken.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're looking for like it's redirecting or calling something in the background, you want to see where it calls.
Yep.
Then I've used that a lot where sometimes there will be a picture or a website or a video. I just want to pull that video off of the website.
Yeah.
And you can't right click on it and grab it. Then those developer tools works really nice.
Yes.
It's just F12.
So you can find all the sources of things.
That's right.
Oh, I didn't know F12 did it too. I've always hit Control Shift I.
Oh.
Because that was some other tool used to use that years ago in Firefox. It was Firefox used to have a plugin called the Web Dev Tools.
Right.
I love those. I used them years ago when I did web development, I don't know, like 2010, 9, something, maybe a longer ago. I forget how long ago that was.
7 years ago.
Well, when you think about it, I'm like, oh, yeah, they have an updated firmware since 2012 on those firewalls for a client. And I'm like, wow, that's 5 years of that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty bad.
Yeah. But that's a long time in internet years, too. Things age fast.
All right. I swear there was something else I was going to talk about, but I think these are from the last.
Yeah, those are the big ones I noticed. The Cisco Telnet one. There's always lots of little errata and bugs and things. And,
yeah.
Quick topic that I thought was interesting, and it's a economics marketing type thing. So I was listening to an interview, and I can't remember the guy's name right now. Really interesting, though. It was about the way humans consolidate things, of the rules of threes in economics, and we end up with only three all the time. Automotives, it happened in. They started talking about brands over the years, oil companies, automotives. And they're kind of right, because now it's S3, Azure, Google Cloud. We've now done it in the tech industry. We've become to the big three.
Yeah,
we had the big three automotives years ago. Now it's the big three there. And it's about how it just kind of occurs. And they found other – it was kind of just a thought-provoking. It also – they said – and this is a weird thing. We've seen the Amazon cloud go down. You know, that was the S3 one. Azure had a major outage. The whole Microsoft sign-in authority broke the other day, which made my phone ring off the hook, and we had to tell everyone on O365, yeah, that sucks. Yeah. They want me to fix it, and I'm just like – well, it's funny. We actually got a call from another client, potentially new client, and that was – they said, we've had too many failures with the other IT company. Like, the other day, we couldn't log in our Office 365. I'm like, I'm going to defend the guy? No one could. Like, he said, well, that's what he told us. I'm like, I'll send you the news article. No one could.
Yeah.
But that led me to wondering, what if Google, Amazon, and Azure have a bad day and it's the same day?
Oh, that'd be bad.
Yeah. What would the internet look like? Because some people, to keep their platforms resilient, will host on two separate boxes. Mm-hmm. What happens if they all have a bad day? What happens then? And it's kind of an interesting thought. We don't have a ton of competition. I mean, there's enough small hoster services, but no one could start a business that competes with the big three right now. You couldn't. There's not an easy way to become an incumbent in that market. You would need something like a nation state like China to say, we're going to get into our own hosting, because remember, China has to host a lot of the stuff here. There's just nothing big enough to host some big Alibaba and things like that. They don't. How are you going to host it? You need a data center.
Yeah.
How do you spin up a data center big enough to do that without trying to, it's a big task.
Yeah.
So and the resilience and everything. So something to think about, something to think about there.
Yeah.
There's also, I'll have to find the link and I'll throw it in the show notes. There's a company that measures downtime by major cloud providers.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And Microsoft has managed, and this is before their outage. I looked it up because they were out the other day. They had already had this year 240 minutes of downtime. So does Amazon because of that. And it started because of a Google conference. This is, I'll tell you what was said at the Google conference. Yeah. It was funny. Google this year, as of March, whatever, when I looked up this article, had 11 minutes of downtime this year. Now, Google had won best in cloud service because of they had 74 cumulative minutes for an entire year of downtime. And their next competitors all had over like 300 minutes, including Microsoft and things like that. So when they got up on stage, they said, well, I've learned that we were awarded the cloud service provider of the year. And it was the day after the Amazon S3. He goes for 2016. He goes, so far, we're pretty far ahead in 2017, too. And I didn't realize, it's all with the Microsoft one. It seems to be the authentication server that goes down. It's like if you're logged in, you're good. But once you log out, try to log back in. Because I know it even affected the Xbox users, which, of course, made the Twitter rants even that much more visceral.
Nice.
Once you take off my Xbox logins, people get angry. Because we can't work because you broke our work login. So now we're going to play Xbox, but that won't log in either. Yeah. It's something to think about, though. It's we need diversity in the ecosphere because that creates the stability. If you find, you create three, we have three attack surfaces.
Yeah.
That's it. The diversity means I can only take down this part of the internet because, well, I found a flaw in the way this XYZ company runs it. Now you just got to find a flaw in the big three.
Right.
And really, not many people are on Azure. It's Google and Amazon right now. Yeah. Azure's coming up, but yeah.
Mm.
I think they're losing some faith in them, though.
Right.
Yeah. I know I am, but I'm sure they'll come around. I don't think they're bad. There's growing pains. The more they embrace Linux, the more they will have uptime.
That's right.
That's why they're loving it so much. Like, wow, it doesn't, because those Windows 10 updates are killer. We got that anniversary update coming from.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Actually, a Craters update, it's called.
A Craters?
It's Creators. Well, Crater, I'm going to call it the Crater. Yeah, but it's called the Craters update. It doesn't have anything to do with creation. It's just a name, literally just a name. And so it's got a lot of people confused because the code name is the Craters update. And super like, is that like people, what is it creating? I'm like, money. It's going to break so many things. I don't know this for a fact other than based on historically when the anniversary came update. Also, did you know it turns off privacy settings? I don't know if they're going to do this again, but one of the big problems is people who run a lot of these updates, like they turn off a lot of the telemetry data for Windows 10, and the telemetry data all turns back on after some of the updates. And they don't know it. It doesn't tell you this. It just starts sending all the telemetry data and Cortana data back out.
Good Lord.
It's got a bunch of privacy people super upset. It's got a bunch of corporate people super upset because now one of the new updates integrates ads into the File Explorer, if you didn't see that.
I have heard about that. That is pretty bad.
For a corporate environment to have ads that are clickable, that are granted they are Microsoft ads for Microsoft products. Mm-hmm. They're still ads because someone said they're not really ads or they're telling you they're suggesting you use other Microsoft products. And I'm like, no, they're ads. Yeah. It's flat out an ad.
They're trying to sell you a service.
They're trying to upsell you, and to upsell corporate individuals on things is pretty shady to me.
I agree.
Because there's not an opt out. Well, there is by going through the settings and privacy settings, but then it's going to update and change them and then come back.
Yeah.
It's a sysadmin nightmare.
Yeah, it's bad.
Yeah.
All right. I don't see any other good stuff coming up.
Nah, we got to do some music now.
Yeah.
The outgoing music for this week's show.
And like I said, we got it through a suggestion from an email. Where'd that email go? Julian. So it's Leopard Girl is the song. It's by the Victators. Phil says that nobody can hear us. Although I can see on here it's making noise. I can see that the sound is going out.
I'll reply to Phil.
Yeah.
I sent a reply. We'll check this out now that the show's over.
Right. Are you sure your speakers aren't muted, Phil?
Yes. Actually, he can't be listening to us right now.
Right, I know. No, so what I can look at is on my screen, I can see sound levels of, of sound coming in. And when I'm talking and when Tom's talking, I can see the sound going up and down. So I can tell that YouTube is hearing us. So I guess we would have to bring up another YouTube stream. There's four people listening, so I don't think we'd have people connected in if they couldn't hear us.
It's Phil.
It's Phil.
If he could hear us, he'd know we're talking about him.
And I'm checking the settings again. Yeah, it has all the correct, like the correct microphone or sound input and the correct camera. And all right, well.
Let's get back to the song. So
all right.
We'll talk about this offline.
That's right. The Leopard Girl. Nice. I really like that.
Yeah.
The surf rock.
That was so good.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the suggestion, Julian. And let's see. Well, I guess we're at the end here.
Yeah.
So you have been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. This was episode 231. I don't know what to call it.
I don't know what to call it.
I don't mean that's, or we don't have a name for it. Or I don't even know what we called it to begin with.
Whatever we called it, we're going to call it at the beginning because now we're confused and didn't write it down.
That's right.
These are discussions that should happen beforehand.
Yeah.
But Tony's going on light amounts of sleep, and so am I. So
that's right. Yeah. Well, and when Mary's not here to keep us on board or on,
we need
track.
A third person to remember what we come up with. This is how this works.
Oh. Oh, you know, I forgot to talk about that. I had to work overnight last night again. And I think this is the last time I think of this major project we've been working on. This is the last part of it.
Upgrading equipment and switching fabric and all that fun stuff.
Yeah. And it actually took down like our primary data center, completely took it offline.
Wow.
Because everything, so the data center, like our circuits come into the data center and it connects to WAN routers. Then those WAN routers connect to core switches, and there's multiple switches. So if something were to break, then we could have a whole switch go down and services will continue until we get that switch fixed. Well, we had to completely replace those two. And so they physically unplugged them, put new ones in, and brought them back up. And we had to make out a list of like all affected applications. And there was like 170 applications and application support people that all had to be on this call. And I think they said there was going to be 300 people on the application support call. And then networking had a separate call.
How long was it down for?
Total, it was down for almost 2 hours.
Wow.
So it was, for the first 45 minutes was our primary applications, like the four biggest ones. They actually wanted to go through and kick people off and then to stop it. So they didn't have like sessions in the middle that are hung while we take things offline. So it took almost 45 minutes for that. And then took us about 45 minutes to an hour to do all of our cut and validation and bring up on the new. And then we spent the next 4 hours troubleshooting different random issues that were coming up related to this. Because we were going from Catalyst core switches, Cisco Catalyst core switches, over to Cisco Nexus core switches. And so they run completely different operating systems. So the same commands, the same features, they're not the same on these two. So one of the problems we had was something related to content filtering, like forwarding on to a content filter system.
Mm-hmm.
They had parity in the options to use, but it wasn't the same system.
The options worked differently.
Yeah, and they worked differently. So we had to figure out what was wrong and was able to fix that. And yeah, so that was another reason that we actually started about a half hour late today, is because I was at work. We were finishing that up, and then I had to come over here.
And I was actually on time today.
Yeah.
So I was diving into my research on fluorescent versus LED lighting and trying to figure out how many lumens each one of them is, because there's so much confusion on that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's not as simple as I thought.
I do the dummy version of that's an equivalent to a 60-watt bulb. I'll buy that one.
Yeah. Because they're the drop-in, what do they call those? They got a name for them. Troffit lights. These ones that are above our heads in a standard drop ceiling. Anyways, there's not that. So the T8s and T12s are more lumens, mm-hmm. but they're omnidirectional lumen versus the lumen from a LED is directional. Right. So I know there's a big wattage difference, but I'm just trying to find them because we're putting new lighting in. It has standard lights like this in. Because we're doing the new build out for the building, one of the things we're doing is upgrading LED lighting. It's all part of the budget. And it's expensive. It's a few $1,000 in lighting. So I'm trying to make sure to find the right brand. I can't hardly find any reviews on any of the brands.
Hmm.
And there's variations. Some are like 3,000 lumen, some are 6,000 lumen. Hmm. They're literally substantial, and it's a logarithmic scale. So as you go up a little bit in lumen, you actually go up a lot in actual brightness. So it gets super not easy to make comparisons and find. I can't find people who did reviews on it. So when I'm done, our first YouTube video about the building, it's going to be the lighting we put in.
Yeah. You could probably put dimmers on it and everything.
Well, and actually that's the thing. They all support dimmers now, which is cool, but I don't care because we just want it bright. So I can't think of a scenario where I want it less bright. I'll just turn it off.
You could. You could do like for security lighting to be able to dim it. You know, a lot of times security lighting, like in your typical, they'll have, instead of four bulbs, only two will light up at night and stuff. So that'll be one thing. You can set it on dimmer for something like
that. The security cameras have incredible night vision, we actually like it dark so the people who may try to break in can't navigate things.
That's actually why. So the cameras can see them, but they can't see
around. That's why when in our building, all lights are off inside the building and we lock. Except we do leave the very front light on. That way the police can see how to get in.
I'm surprised your security system or your security like company would allow for that,
The night vision on our cameras is that good.
Oh, they say, oh, you got night vision cameras, so you're good for that.
They are scary bright. Hmm. It's almost creepy. I'm going to do, we're switching to Unify. So next building, we're doing new security camera ones, but the old ones are good. But the new ones we're going to do is the Unify ones. Oh, man, are they bright.
Yeah.
They are. You can see so much more detail. And the old ones are good. So, and they're all, everything we have now is full 1080 at 30 frames a second that we record. So it's not only good, you can see a lot of detail.
All right.
Huh. So anyways, a whole nother topic.
That's really cool.
A whole nother topic.
So, all right.
All right. We're done. We can keep going, but I think we got some other stuff to do, and Tony wants to go to sleep.
Yeah, I'm pretty tired. Actually, we're going over to my parents' house. My dad's birthday is today.
Oh,
so we're gonna
birthday and then crash hard.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to crash on the way. My wife's going to drive. I'm going to sleep on the way. And
there you go.
Yeah.
Catch a nap.
Yeah. all right. So, and then, so for every free YouTube listeners.
If you're listening and if it's working.
Right. We typically would record our second episode right now, and we're not going to do that. Because we didn't prepare.
Yeah, we didn't prepare. But I might find the time to do some things. I may be able to do one on FreeNAS. We'll do a fresh looks on it as I've got material. So,
okay. I'll see what I can do. If I can bring some, think something up, then I'll do it.
And get it published. We'll figure it out. We always do. Behind the scenes is ugly, folks.
Right. So just remember, if you want to listen to the edited version, go to smlr.us. You can subscribe to our RSS feeds. We have both the MP3 and AUG feeds for that. Subscribe to our YouTube channel so you can always get updates. We do post it when we're going live. We always post live on Google Plus.
And IRC.
And IRC. And if you're following my Facebook feed, then you'll see my Facebook pop up. And
it's generally Sunday mornings at 7:00 something every Sunday. I'm not going to say 7 o'clock.
Somewhere between 7:30 and 8 o'clock is typically when we start.
Yeah. We get here at 7 and we got to turn things on and all that.
It's every other Sunday.
It's every other Sunday. Yeah.
And I guess that's
a wrap.
The other thing, if you're going to try to plan ahead and want to listen to us and you want to make sure we're going to be on that day.
Message us.
Yeah, just send us an email or something. Or
we're pretty responsive.
Them. Yeah. We try to be.
We try to be. We work hard at it.
That's right. All right. So I guess we're coming to the end. Soundboard?
Soundboard. Go, soundboard, go.
Somewhere around here.
You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. If you would like more information about this or other shows, go to smlr.us. Feel free to send comments to show@smlr.us or give us a call at 734-258-7009. I'm John Miller. If you don't like it, you can
bite my 8-bit metal ass. That's bite with a Y.